The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 9, Side 1.
In the most general sense, the word Volnyashka means just any free person. In other words, any citizen of the Soviet Union not just arrested or already released, and therefore every citizen of Kamtside. But most often this word was used in the archipelago in the narrow sense. A volnyashka is that particular kind of free person who worked alongside prisoners in the same work compound. By this token, those in groups 1, 5, and 6 above, who came to the camp work compound to work, were also volnyashki. Volnyashki were hired as construction superintendents, foremen, head foremen, warehouse managers, and norm setters. In addition, they were hired for those posts in which the employment of Zeks would have made the work of the convoy much more difficult. Drivers, draymen, dispatchers, tractor drivers, excavator operators, scraper operators, electrical linemen, night firemen. These second-class volnyashki, ordinary sloggers like the Zeks, made friends with us right away without nonsense, and did everything forbidden by the camp regimen and by criminal law. They willingly deposited the Zeks' letters in the free mailboxes of the settlement. They took and sold at the local free markets clothes the Zeks had pinched in camp and kept the money, bringing the Zeks some grub. Together with the Zeks, they also plundered the project. They brought vodka into the work compound. Despite very strict inspection at the gatehouse, they would drop flasks of vodka with tarred necks into the gasoline tanks of automobiles. And if it happened that the guard found them, there would still be no official report filed with the chief. The Komsomol guards preferred to drink any contraband vodka themselves. And wherever it was possible to credit the Zeks' work to free people, the foremen and the head foremen were not at all squeamish about crediting themselves too. This was invariably done. After all, work credited to a prisoner did nothing for anyone. No one paid any money for it, but only gave them a bread ration. And that was why in unrationed times it made good sense to complete the Zeks worksheet any old way, just so there was no serious trouble, and to credit the Zeks work to a free man. The Volnyashka got money for it, and he ate and drank himself, and gave his own Zeks something to eat as well. The great advantage of working in Kamtside could easily be observed even among the free employees of the Moscow camps. At our camp at the Kaluga Gates in 1946, there were two free bricklayers, one plasterer, one painter. They were listed as being employed at our construction project. As far as work went, they did almost none, because the project could not pay them large wages. There were no special bonus wages here, and all the areas were measured off exactly. For plastering one square yard, they got 32 kopecks, and it was simply impossible to charge 1.5 rubles per yard, or to inflate the square yards to 3 times more than the room measured. But, in the first place, our free employees hauled off cement, paint, linseed oil, and glass, and in the second place, they got a good rest during their 8-hour work day. And so at night and on Sundays, they could really put their hearts into their main work, their work on the left, private work. And there they made their money up. For the same square yard of wall space, that same plasterer got not 32 kopecks, but 10 rubles from a private person. And in the course of one evening, he would earn 200 rubles. After all, as Prokhorov said, money nowadays comes in 2 stories. What Westerner could comprehend 2-story money? A lathe operator during the war received, after deductions, 800 rubles a month, and bread cost 140 rubles on the open market. And that meant that in the course of 1 month he did not earn enough for even 6 kilos of bread, over and above his ration. In other words, he could not bring home even 7 ounces a day for the whole family. But at the same time he did live. With frank and open impudence they paid the workers an unreal wage, and let them go and seek the second story. And the person who paid our plasterer insane money for his evening's work also got to the second story on his own in some particular way. Thus it was that the socialist system triumphed, but only on paper. The old ways, tenacious, flexible, never died out as a result of either curses or persecution by the prosecutors. And so, in general, you could not call the relations between the Zeks and the Volniashki hostile. Instead, they were friendly, and these lost, half-drunken, ruined people were more sensitive to the grief of others, were capable of paying heed to the grief of a prisoner and the injustice of his arrest. The eyes of an unprejudiced human being were open to what the eyes of the officers, jailers, and guards were closed to because of their position. The relations between the Zeks and the foreman and the head foreman were more complex. As commanders of production, they were put there to squeeze the prisoners and drive them. But they were answerable for the course of the work, and the work couldn't always be carried out in a condition of direct hostility between them and the Zeks. Not everything can be got by hunger and the stick. Some things require willing agreement, both by inclination and by imagination. And the only foremen who were successful were those who reached an understanding with the brigadiers and with the best of the skilled craftsmen among the prisoners. And the foremen themselves were not just drunks and not simply enfeebled and poisoned by the constant employment of slave labor. They were also illiterate, and either knew nothing of their line of work or else knew it very, very badly, and because of this were even more dependent on the brigadiers. And how interestingly Russian fates sometimes intertwined there. A carpenter's foreman, Fyodor Ivanovich Muravlyov, came to us in his cups before a holiday and bared his soul to the brigadier of painters, Sinebryukov, an outstanding master of his trade, a serious, steadfast fellow who was serving out his 10th year.
"What? You're serving time, you kulak son? Your father kept ploughing away at the land and accumulated cows and figured he would take it all off to the kingdom of heaven. And where is he now? He died in exile, and they imprisoned you too. No, my father was smarter than that. From his earliest years he drank down everything and our hut was empty, and he didn't even give his chickens to the collective farm because he didn't have any or anything else. And right off they made him a brigadier, and I take after him, drinking vodka, and I know no grief." And as it turned out, he was right. Sinebryukov, after serving out his sentence, would be sent off to exile, and Muravlyov would become the chairman of the Trade Union Committee on Construction. True, the construction superintendent Buzlov could not wait to get rid of this chairman of the local trade union committee and foreman. It was impossible to get rid of him. It was the personnel department that hired, not the construction superintendent, and the personnel department would often select loafers and dolts out of a feeling of kinship. The construction superintendent answered for all the materials and wage fund out of his own pocket, but Muravlyov, out of illiteracy, or else because he was a simpleton, and he was not at all a malicious character, and because of this the brigadiers used to carry him, would squander that wage fund, sign unexamined work vouchers, which the brigadiers would fill in themselves, and accept badly done work, which would then have to be broken up and done over again. And Buzlov would have been glad to replace that kind of foreman with a Zek engineer who was working there with a pick. But because of vigilance, the personnel department did not permit this. "Well, now, tell me, what length beams do you have at the moment on the site?" Muravlyov sighed deeply. "For the time being, I hesitate to tell you exactly." And the drunker Muravlyov got, the more impudently he used to speak to the construction superintendent. And at that point, the construction superintendent decided to besiege him with paperwork. Despite the time it cost, he began to put all his orders in writing, keeping carbons in a file. These orders were not executed, of course, and a fearsome case was being built up. But the chairman of the local union was not at a loss. He got himself a half sheet of wrinkled notebook paper and took half an hour to scrawl out with difficulty, clumsily, "I bring to your information that all mechanisms which are for carpentry work in not working order, which is in a bad state and exclusively do not work."
The construction superintendent was quite a different level of work management. For the prisoners, he was a constant oppressor and a constant enemy. The construction superintendent would not enter either into friendly relations with the brigadiers or into deals with them. He used to cut back their worksheets, expose their tuchta, to the extent that he was smart enough, and he could always punish a brigadier and any prisoner through the camp administration. To Camp Chief Lieutenant, I request you to punish in the severest manner, preferably in punishment cell, but with his being taken out to work, the brigadier of the cement workers, the prisoner Zodzulia, and the foreman, the prisoner Orachevsky, for casting slabs thicker than the indicated measurement in which was expressed an overexpenditure of cement. Simultaneously, I wish to inform you that this day, in dealing with me on the question of registering the volume of work in the worksheets, the prisoner Brigadier Alexeyev insulted the foreman, Comrade Tumarkin, calling him a jackass. Such conduct on the part of the prisoner Alexeyev, which undermines the authority of the free administration, I consider extremely undesirable and even dangerous, and beg you to take the firmest measures up to and including his being sent away on a prisoner transport. Senior Construction Supervisor Buzlov. This very Tumarkin had, in a suitable moment, been called a jackass by Buzlov himself, but the Czech brigadier, on the basis of his worth, deserved a prisoner transport. Buzlov sent the camp chiefs such notes nearly every day. He saw the camp punishments as the highest form of work stimulus. Buzlov was one of those work bosses who had worked himself into the gulag system and who had adapted himself to the ways of getting things done. That's what he said at meetings. I have long experience of work with the Czechs, and I do not fear their threats to flatten me with a brick. But, he regretted, the gulag generations had changed for the worse. The people who came to camp after the war, and after Europe, turned out to be disrespectful types. But working in 1937, you understand, that was pure pleasure. For example, when a free employee entered, the Czechs invariably rose to their feet. Buzlov knew both how to deceive the prisoners and how to put them in dangerous situations, and he never spared their strength, nor their stomachs, nor still less their vanity. Long-nosed, long-legged, wearing yellow American Oxfords donated to needy Soviet citizens, which he had received through UNRWA, he perpetually rushed around the floors of the construction, knowing that otherwise the lazy, dirty beings called Zeka Zeka would be sitting in all his corners and crannies, lying, warming themselves, looking for lice, or even copulating, notwithstanding the urgency of the short 10-hour working day, and the brigadiers would be crowding the norms office and writing up tuchta, false figures, on worksheets. And out of all the foremen, there was only one on whom he partially relied, Fyodor Vasilyevich Gorshkov. He was a puny old guy with bristling grey moustaches. He had a keen understanding of the construction, and he knew both his own work and that contiguous to his. And his principal and unusual trait among the Volnyashki was the fact that he had an honest interest in the outcome of the construction. Not a pocket interest, like Buzlov. Would they fine him or give him a bonus, curse him out or praise him? But an inner interest, just as if he were building the whole enormous building for himself and wanted it to be as good as possible. He was a careful drinker, too, and never lost sight of the construction. But he had one major shortcoming. He had not adjusted to the archipelago, and he was unaccustomed to keeping the prisoners in terror. He also liked to go around the construction and peer searchingly with his own eyes. However, he did not rush about like Buzlov, and he was not trying to catch those who were cheating, and he liked to sit down and chat with the carpenters on the beams, with the bricklayers at their bricklaying, with the plasterers at their mixing box. Sometimes he shared candies with the Czechs, a wondrous thing to us. There was one kind of work which even in his old age he simply could not get along without, glass cutting. He always had his own diamond glass cutter in his pocket, and if someone started cutting glass in his presence, he would begin to hoot right off that they were cutting it wrong, and he would push the glass workers away and cut it himself. Buzlov went off for a month to Sochi, and Fyodor Vasilyevich replaced him. But he refused flatly to sit in Buzlov's office and remained right in the foreman's common room. The whole winter, Gorshov went about in an old Russian short, Podyovka, a wasted coat. Its collar had grown threadbare, but the outside material was remarkably well preserved. They used to say of that Podyovka that Gorshov had been wearing it for going on 31 years without ever taking it off, and that before that his father had worn it for some years on holidays. And thus it developed that his father, Vasily Gorshkov, had been a government foreman. And then it was understandable why Fyodor Vasilich liked brick and wood and glass and paint so much. From childhood, he had grown up on construction works. But even though the foremen were then called government foremen, and even though they are not called government foremen now, the time they actually became government foremen is now, whereas before they were artists. And Fyodor Vasilich would even now praise the old ways. What's a construction superintendent nowadays? He isn't able to shift even one kopeck from one place to another. In the old days, the contractor would come to the workers on Saturday. Well, boys, will it be before the bath or after? And they would answer, afterward, uncle, afterward. Well, here's your bath money, and from there to the tavern. The boys would pour out of the baths in a crowd, and the contractor would be waiting for them with vodka, snacks, and a samovar. Just try, after all that, to work badly on Monday. For us today, everything has a name, and we know everything about everything. This was the speed-up system, merciless exploitation, playing on the lowest human instincts. And the drinks and the spread that went with them weren't worth what was squeezed out of the worker the following week. And a bread ration, a wet bread ration hurled by indifferent hands from the window of the bread-cutting room, now, was that really worth any more? So all eight of these classifications of free inhabitants elbowed one another on the crowded square inch of camp side, between camp and forest, between forest and swamp, between camp and mine. Eight different categories, various ranks and classes, and all had to fit into that stench-ridden, crowded settlement. They were all comrades to each other, and they sent their children to the same school. The kind of comrades they were such that, like saints in the clouds, up above everyone else, two or three local magnates floated. In Ekibastuts their names were Kishchuk and Karashchuk, the director and the chief engineer of the trust, and I did not think up those names. And then in descending order, with sharp lines of division carefully observed, the chief of camp, the commander of the convoy battalion, other ranking officials of the trust, and officers of the camp, officers of the battalion, and in places the director of the workers' supply section, and in places the director of the school, but not the teachers. And the higher they went, the more jealously the walls separating them were guarded, and the greater the significance attached to which woman could go to visit whom, so that they could sit and chew sunflower seeds together. They were not princesses, nor even countesses, and so they looked around all the more vigilantly to make sure their position had not been degraded. Oh, what a doomed state it was to live in this narrow world far away from other well-provided-for families, living in comfortable, spacious cities. Here, everyone knew you, and you couldn't just get up and go to the movies without lowering yourself, and of course you could not go to a store, the more so since they brought the best and the freshest things to your home. It even seemed improper to keep your own piglet. It was demeaning for the wife of so-and-so to feed it with her own hands. That is why it was necessary to have a servant from the camp. And in the several wards of the settlement hospital, how difficult it was to keep apart from the tatterdemalions and trash and to lie among decent neighbours. And you had to send your nice children to sit behind the same desks with whom? But further down, these dividing walls quickly lost their precision and their significance, and there were no longer any troublemaking meddlers to keep watch over them. Further down, the categories inevitably commingled, encountered each other, bought and sold together, ran to get in lines and argued about the New Year's tree gifts from the trade unions, sat all mixed up together any which way at the movies, both genuine Soviet people and those totally unworthy of this title. One spiritual centre of such settlements was the main tea room, in some rotting barracks near which the trucks lined up, and from which the drunkards, howling out songs, belching and stumbling, wandered around through the whole settlement. And among the very same mud puddles and mass of squishy mud was the second spiritual centre, the club, its floor covered with hulls of spat-out sunflower seeds, scuffed by boots, with a fly-blown wall newspaper from the previous year, with the constantly grumbling loudspeaker over the door, with the good old mother curses at the dances, and the knife fights after the film show. The style and tone of the local places was, "Don't be out late." And if you took a girl to a dance, the safest thing to do was to put a horseshoe in your mitten. Yes, and some of the girls there were such that even a gang of seven youths would flee from them. This club was a knife in the officers' hearts. Naturally, it was quite impossible for officers to go to dances in a shed like that, among people of that kind. The enlisted men of the guard went there when they were on leave passes. But the trouble was that the young, childless officers' wives were drawn there too, even without their husbands, and they would end up dancing with the enlisted men. Rank-and-file soldiers embraced the officers' wives. So how could you expect faultless obedience from them on duty the next day? After all, this was equality, and no army can stand up under those conditions. Unable to prevent their wives from going to the dances, the officers managed to get the dances declared out of bounds to enlisted men. Let some dirty volnyashki embrace their wives. But what this did was to introduce a crack in the symmetry of the political indoctrination of the enlisted men, that we are all happy and equal citizens of the Soviet state, and that our enemies are, you see, behind barbed wire. Many such complex tensions were hidden in Campside, and many contradictions among its eight categories. Mingling in everyday life with the repressed and semi-repressed, honest Soviet citizens would not neglect to reproach them and put them in their place, especially when it was a matter of a room in a new barracks. And the jailers, as wearers of the MVD uniform, claimed to be on a higher plane than the ordinary free people. And then there were invariably women in everyone's bad books, because all the single guys would have been lost without them. And there were also women who had plans for getting a permanent man. That kind would go to the camp gatehouse when they knew there would be a release, and they would grab complete strangers by the sleeve. "Come to my place. I have a place, and I will keep you warm. I will buy you a suit." "Well, where are you going?" "After all, they'll just jug you again." And there was also a security surveillance over the whole settlement. The settlement had its own godfather, and its own stoolies, and they would flex their muscles. Just who was taking letters from the Zex to be mailed outside, and who was selling camp clothing behind the corner of the barracks. And then, too, of course, there was less sense of the presence of the law among the inhabitants of Campside than anywhere else in the Soviet Union, or that their barracks room was a castle. Some had unclean passports, and others had no passports at all, and others had been imprisoned in camp themselves, and others were members of families. And thus, all these independent, unconvoyed citizens were even more obedient than the prisoners to the command of a man with a rifle, even more meek in the face of the man with a revolver. When they saw one, they did not throw back their proud heads and declare, "You don't have the right." They would shrink and bow their heads and slink past. And this sense of the unlimited power of the bayonet and the uniform hovered so confidently over the expanses of the archipelago and Campside, so communicated itself to everyone who entered the region, that the free woman, P. Blank China, who flew to Krasnoyarsk with her little girl to visit her husband in camp, allowed herself to be searched and patted all over at the first demand of the MVD officials in the plane, and allowed her child to be completely undressed. Since then, the little girl has wept every time she has seen the sky blues. But if someone now says that there is nothing sadder than these camp environs and that campsite is a sewer, we will reply, that depends on the individual. A Yakut named Kolodeznikov got 3 years in 1932 for rustling reindeer, and under our perspicacious relocation policy, was sent from his native Kolyma to serve his time near Leningrad. He served out his time and was in Leningrad itself, and he brought his family some bright-coloured dress materials, yet for many years after complained to his fellow tribesmen and to the Zeks who had been sent from Leningrad, "Oh, it's boring where you come from. It's awful." Chapter 22. We are building. After everything that has been said about the camps, the question simply bursts out. That's enough. But was the prisoner's labour profitable to the state? And if it was not profitable, then was it worthwhile undertaking the whole archipelago? In the camps themselves, both points of view on this were to be found among the Zeks, and we used to love to argue about it. Of course, if one believed the leaders, there was nothing to argue about. On the subject of the use of the prisoner's labour, Comrade Molotov, once the second-ranking man in the state, declared at the 6th Congress of the Soviets of the USSR, "We did this earlier, we are doing it now, and we are going to go on doing it in the future. It is profitable to society, it is useful to the criminals." Not profitable to the state, note that, but to society itself, and useful to the criminals. And we will go on doing it in the future. So what is there to argue about? Yes, the entire system of the Stalin decades, when first the construction projects were planned, and only afterward the recruitment of criminals to man them took place, confirms that the government evidently had no doubt of the economic profitability of the camps. Economics went before justice. But it is quite evident that the question posed needs to be made more precise and to be split into parts. Did the camps justify themselves in a political and social sense? Did they justify themselves economically? Did they pay for themselves? Despite the apparent similarity of the second and third questions, there is a difference. It is not difficult to answer the first question. For Stalin's purposes, the camps were a wonderful place into which he could herd millions as a form of intimidation, and so it appears that they justified themselves politically. The camps were also profitable in lucre to an enormous social stratum, the countless number of camp officers. They gave them military service, safely in the rear, special rations, pay, uniforms, apartments, and a position in society. Likewise, they sheltered throngs of jailers and hard-head guards who dozed atop camp towers, while 13-year-old boys were driven into trade schools. And all these parasites upheld the archipelago with all their strength as a nest of serf exploitation. They feared a universal amnesty like the plague. But we have already understood that by no means only those with different ideas, by no means only those who had got off the trodden path marked out by Stalin were in the camps. The recruitment into camps obviously and clearly exceeded political needs, exceeded the needs of terror. It was proportionate, although perhaps in Stalin's head alone, to economic plans. Yes, and had not the camps and exile arisen out of the crisis unemployment of the 20s? From 1930 on, it was not that the digging of canals was invented for dozing camps, but that camps were urgently scraped together for the envisioned canals. It was not the number of genuine criminals, or even doubtful persons, which determined the intensity of the court's activities, but the requisitions of the economic establishment. At the beginning of the Belomore Canal, there was an immediate shortage of Solovetsky Island's Zeks, and it became clear that 3 years was too short and too unprofitable a sentence for the 58s, that they had to serve out 2 5-year plans taken together. The reason why the camps proved economically profitable had been foreseen as far back as Thomas More, the great-grandfather of socialism, in his Utopia. The labor of the Zecs was needed for degrading and particularly heavy work, which no one under socialism would wish to perform. For work in remote and primitive localities, where it would not be possible to construct housing, schools, hospitals, and stores for many years to come. For work with pick and spade in the flowering of the 20th century. For the erection of the great construction projects of socialism, when the economic means for them did not yet exist. On the great Bellamore Canal, even an automobile was a rarity. Everything was created, as they say in camp, with fart power. On the even larger Moscow-Volga Canal, 7 times bigger in scale of work than the Bellamore Canal, and comparable to the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal, 80 miles of canal were dug to a depth of over 16 feet and a top width of 280 feet, and almost all of it with pick, shovel, and wheelbarrow. So each time you ride along the canal in a motorboat, remember those who lie on its bottom. The future bottom of the Rybinsk Sea was covered with forest expanses. All of them were cut down by hand, and nary an electric saw was seen there, and the branches and brushwood were burned by total invalids. Who, except prisoners, would have worked at logging 10 hours a day, in addition to marching 4 miles through the woods in pre-dawn darkness, and the same distance back at night, in a temperature of -20, and knowing in a year no other rest days than May the 1st and November the 7th? Volgolag, 1937. And who, other than the archipelago natives, would have grubbed out stumps in winter, or hauled on their backs the boxes of mined ore in the open gold fields of the Kalima, or have dragged cut timber 1/2 mile from the Queen River, a tributary of the Vim, through deep snow on Finnish timber sledge runners, harnessed up in pairs in a horse collar, the collar bows upholstered with tatters of rotten clothing to make them softer, and the horse collar worn over one shoulder. True, the authorized journalist Y. Zhukov assures us the Komsomols built the city of Komsomolsk on the Amur in 1932, thus, they cut down trees without axes, having no smithies, got no bread, and died from scurvy. And he is delighted. Oh, how heroically we built, and would it not be more to the point to be indignant? Who was it, hating their own people, who sent them to build in such conditions? But what's the use of indignation? We at least know what kind of Komsomols built Komsomolsk. And today they write that those Komsomols founded Magadan too. And who could be sent down into the Zhezkazgan mines for a 12-hour work day of dry drilling? The silicate dust from the ore there floated about in clouds, and there were no masks, and in 4 months they were sent off to die of irreversible silicosis. Who could be sent down coal mine shafts on lifts without brake shoes, into mine tunnels without pit props, without protection against flooding? For whom alone in the 20th century was it unnecessary to spend money on wasteful workmen's safety precautions? And how was it then that the camps were economically unprofitable? Read, read. In The Dead Road by Popovzhy, that description of how they disembarked from and unloaded the lighters on the Taz River, that Arctic Iliad of the Stalinist epoch, how, in the savage tundra, where human foot had never trod, the ant-like prisoners, guarded by an ant-like convoy, dragged thousands of shipped-in logs on their backs, and built wharves, and laid down rails, and rolled into that tundra locomotives and freight cars, which were fated never to leave there under their own power. They slept 5 hours a day on the bare ground, surrounded by signboards saying, Camp Compound. And he describes further how the prisoners laid a telephone line through the tundra. They lived in lean-tos made of branches and moss. The mosquitoes devoured their unprotected bodies. Their clothing never dried out from the swamp mud, still less their footgear. The route had been surveyed, hit or miss, and poorly laid out, and was doomed to be redrawn. And there was no timber nearby for poles, and they had to go off to either side on 2- and 3-day expeditions in order to drag in poles from out there. There was, unfortunately, no other Pobozhi to tell how, before the war, another railroad was built from Kotlas to Vorkuta, where beneath each tie 2 heads were left. And what kind of a railroad was it when before that railroad they laid alongside it a simple road of ties through an impenetrable forest, built by skinny arms, dull axes, and do-nothing bayonets? Now, who would have done that without prisoners? And how on earth could the camps not be profitable? The camps were uniquely profitable in terms of the submissiveness of the slave labor and its cheapness. No, it was not just cheap, it cost nothing, because in antiquity money did have to be paid for a slave, whereas no one paid anything to buy a camp inmate. Even at the post-war camp conferences, the industrial serf owners admitted that the ZKZK played a big role in the work in the rear, in the victory. But no one will ever engrave their forgotten names on a marble tombstone placed over their bones. How irreplaceable the camps were was discovered in Khrushchev's time during the bothersome, vociferous Komsomol appeals for volunteers for the Virgin Lands and construction projects in Siberia. The question of the camps paying for themselves was, however, a different question. The state's saliva had been flowing over this for a long time. As long ago as the statutes on places of confinement, in 1921, there had been the plea that places of confinement must, if possible, pay their way with the labor of the prisoners. From 1922 on, certain local executive committees, going against their worker and peasant character, manifested tendencies of an apolitical pragmatism. And in particular, not only did they seek to have the places of confinement pay their own way, but they tried, in addition, to squeeze profits out of them for the local budget, to make them self-supporting plus. The corrective labor code of 1924 also demanded that places of confinement be self-supporting. In 1928, at the first all-union conference of penitentiary executives, there was stubborn insistence that there must be an obligatory reimbursement to the state by the entire network of enterprises of places of confinement of expenditures by the state on these places of confinement. They so wanted to have their little camps, and free, too. From 1929, all the corrective labor institutions of the country were included in the economic plan. And on January the 1st, 1931, it was decreed that all camps and colonies in the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic and the Ukraine were to become completely self-supporting. And what happened next? Instant success, of course. In 1932, the jurists proclaimed triumphantly, "The expenditures on corrective labor institutions have been reduced." This can be believed. "And the conditions in which those deprived of freedom are maintained are improving with each year." We would be surprised, and we would try to find out why this happened and how, if we ourselves hadn't experienced on our own backs just exactly how that maintenance improved later on. But if you come to think about it, it wasn't so very difficult at all. What was required to make expenditures on camps equal the income from them? The expenditures, as we read, were being reduced. To increase income was even simpler by squeezing the prisoners. If, in the Solovetsky Islands period of the archipelago, an official 40% discount was applied to forced labor, the assumption being, for some reason, that labor performed under a club was not so productive. Then as early as the Belomor Canal, when the stomach scale of compensation was introduced, the scholars of Gulag discovered that, on the contrary, forced and hungry labor was the most productive in the world. The Ukrainian camp administration, when ordered to become self-supporting in 1931, decided directly to increase the productivity of labor in the coming year by neither more nor less than 242%. 100, 42%, in comparison with the preceding years. In other words, by 2.5 times and without any mechanization. And how scientifically this worked out, 240 and another 2%. The only thing the comrades did not know was what this is called is the Great Leap Forward beneath three red banners. And you see how Gulag knew in which direction the wind was blowing. Right then was when the immortally historic 6 conditions of Comrade Stalin poured forth, among them self-support. But we in Gulag already have it. We already have it. And once again, the use of specialists. But for us this was the easiest of all, to take the engineers off general work, assign them to post as work trustees. The beginning of the 30s was the most privileged period for the technical intelligentsia in the archipelago. Almost none of them were forced to drag out an existence at general work, and even newcomers were immediately established in their field of specialization. Up to that time, in the 20s, engineers and technicians perished for nothing on general work, because they were not deployed or made use of. After this period, from 1937 right up to the 50s, self-support was forgotten, and all the historic 6 conditions along with it. And the main thing historically then became vigilance, and the infiltration of the engineers, one by one, into trusty ranks, alternated with waves of expelling them all to general work. Anyway, it was cheaper, too, to have a prisoner engineer rather than a free person. No wages had to be paid him. Once again, profit. Once again, self-support. Once again, Comrade Stalin was right. So this line had been drawn out of the distant past, and they had carried it on correctly, too. The archipelago had to cost nothing. But no matter how they huffed and puffed and broke all their nails on the crags, no matter how they corrected the plan fulfillment sheets 20 times over and wore them down to holes in the paper, the archipelago did not pay its own way, and it never will. The income from it would never equal the expenses. And our young workers' and peasants' state, subsequently the elderly state of all the people, is forced to haul this filthy, bloody bag along on its back. And here's why. The first and principal cause was the lack of conscientiousness of the prisoners, the negligence of those stupid slaves. Not only couldn't you expect any socialist self-sacrifice of them, but they didn't even manifest simple capitalist diligence. All they were on the lookout for was ways to spoil their foot gear and not go out to work. How to wreck a crane, to buckle a wheel, to break a spade, to sink a pail. Anything for a pretext to sit down and smoke. All that the camp inmates made for their own dear state was openly and blatantly botched. You could break the bricks they made with your bare hands. The paint would peel off the panels. The plaster would fall off. Posts would fall down. Tables rock. Legs fall out. Handles come off. Carelessness and mistakes were everywhere. And it could happen that you had to tear off a roof already nailed on, redig the ditch they had filled in, demolish with crowbar and drill a wall they had already built. In the 50s, they brought a new Swedish turbine to Steplag. It came in a frame made of logs like a hut. It was winter, and it was cold, and so the cursed Zeks crawled into this frame between the beams and the turbine and started a bonfire to get warm. The silver, soldering on the blades, melted, and they threw the turbine out. It cost 3,700,000 rubles. Now, that's being self-supporting for you. And in the presence of the Zeks, and this was a second reason, the free employees didn't care either, as though they were working not for themselves, but for some stranger or other, and they stole a lot, they stole a great, great deal. They were building an apartment building, and the free employees stole several bathtubs, but the tubs had been supplied to match the number of apartments, so how could they hand over the apartment building as completed? They could not confess to the construction superintendent, of course. He was triumphantly showing the official acceptance committee around the first stair landing, yes, And he did not omit to take them into every bathroom, too, and show them each tub. And then he took the committee to the second floor landing, and the third, not hurrying there either, and kept going into all the bathrooms. And meanwhile, the adroit and experienced Zex, under the leadership of an experienced foreman plumber, broke bathtubs out of the apartments on the first landing, hauled them upstairs on tiptoe to the fourth floor, and hurriedly installed and putted them in before the committee's arrival. And it was their lookout if they let the wall be pulled over their own eyes. They ought to be shown in a film comedy, but they wouldn't allow it. There is nothing funny in our life. Everything funny takes place in the West. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.